I want to mention the topic and the reason for the choice of this. What we've noticed from our campus chapters over the last year especially is that neuroscience and the soul, for whatever reason, is the most popularly acclaimed title. Every campus, it seems, wants to have a talk on neuroscience and the soul. And this was sort of surprising to us, why the interest in this. And so I've had a chance to be at a number of these talks, and I see the Q&A go a particular direction each time. And it inevitably arises that there are questions about the afterlife and questions that really can be answered best by appealing to theology, by the fullness of revelation. And so that's why I wanted to design a retreat in a series of topics where we have not only a philosophical consideration of the human person, but also a theological one. And so the first three talks in particular will be more philosophical. And then with Father Brian, the last two talks will really get into more what we know about the life after death through revelation. So my talk really is meant to be introductory, to kind of set the stage for the particular talks that follow, and to give a general account of Aquinas' philosophical anthropology, an introduction to human nature, according to Aquinas. So if you're already familiar with Aquinas' anthropology, my approach might be, I should say the content here will be familiar, but my approach will be a little bit unique. And this partly arises from my own interest in the Neoplatonic elements of Aquinas' thought. So I'll be situating this introduction into Aquinas on human nature within, let's say, an understanding of the hierarchy of being. People are confused about human nature. Man is puzzled by man, by himself, and by those around him. And not just as individuals, and when we say to someone else, "I just don't know why you do that," or "I can't understand you." We're not just confused about other individuals, but about human nature itself. And there seems to be a vast disagreement, for instance, on what it means to be human, what the goal of life is, what it means to flourish, and what the real difference is between human beings and other non-human animals, like dogs and squirrels. Now, part of this is a positive confusion, because we're reckoning with a very deep truth with the nature of the human person. And it's true indeed that we're not simple, and there's a great beauty and depth and complexity we have to contemplate. And this is the kind of reaction the psalmist has in saying to God, "I praise you for the wonders of my being, for the wonders of all your creation." There's also a kind of negative confusion we all know well, that people simply don't know the basic truths about human nature. They're confused about themselves. And yet it's critically important to have a proper understanding of the human person. Because really, after knowing God, the most important next thing to know is ourselves, to know about human nature. You can think of all of the implications. We need to know something about the basics of our human nature to be able to live a moral life, to live in harmony with God and others, and to participate in society. So that's all the kind of introductory setting the stage. But where do we begin? What are the points of truth we can cling to understand our human nature? Well, I think one of the main difficulties about understanding the human person is that we're unlike anything else in creation. There's nothing else in the world that we can point to, other than another human being, really, and say, "There, I'm exactly like that." We can't say, "See that squirrel? I'm just like him." Or, "See that chimpanzee? Well, he and I, we're the same kind of thing." It's true we might say this, but at best we'd only mean it metaphorically. "I really identify with that squirrel, that chimpanzee." Or at worst, we would just be crazy. But the best we could probably do, and this would only be the case if we could see angels, point to an angel and a primate and say, "I fall somewhere between these guys. I'm to be found somewhere between the lowliest of guardian angel and the most advanced hominid that walked the earth prior to human beings." So even if per se, per impossibile, we had glasses that could see angels, and even if we had a time machine to find a specimen from that ideal point in evolution when big-brained beings were coming out of Africa, even then we'd only be able to approximate ourselves between them. So, in addition to not having anything quite like ourselves to point to, many find the human person just conceptually messy. Our minds are ordered towards knowing the essences of material things. And so when we begin analyzing something, we have a tendency to reify it, to make it into a thing in order to understand it. So when we begin to say that the human person is composed of a body and a spiritual soul, we then immediately try to turn to either one of those things and treat it completely independent of the other. So as we know from popular understandings, we conceive of the soul as a kind of ghost, or the body as being just fine as a body without the soul. But part of why the truth, or the most satisfying account, is something we have to work for is it's something we need to apply a lot of intellectual energy to. We need to use images and come up with better ones, and then recognize the limits of those images and purify them yet further. If you've studied any natural theology or any of Aquinas' philosophical account of God, you'll know that there's a very important preparatory stage when we follow the way of negation and say what God is not before we begin saying what we can know about him. Well, in a similar way, we need to purify ourselves from our notions, our let's say, poor notions of the soul. We need to say what the soul is not first. So there's nothing quite like us in the rest of creation, and there's a conceptual rigor demanded in coming to a proper understanding of the human person. And so I think for these two reasons, many people shy away and despair of finding answers, or they give up hope for being able to know much for certain. They think human nature is completely opaque and subject to as much subjectivistic interpretation as our preference in movies or in music or in hobbies. I saw a commercial yesterday where someone was being interviewed who studies butterflies, and he said, "It's the essence of my life to know as much about butterflies as possible." And you know, if you take the word essence in a philosophical sense, it's going to create a very strange vision of the human person. What is man? He is knowing butterflies. So I think these two difficulties are compounded by a third sneaking suspicion. Many people, when they encounter claims about the human person, especially ones so rich and robust as the Thomistic account, assume that we're making exceptions for ourselves as human beings. What do I mean? Well, they think, well, there's nothing else really like us, and the best you can offer me is a seemingly complicated account. Perhaps, they say, you're just constructing a view of reality around the human person. Or, at the very least, you're giving the human person an overly privileged place in your account of reality. They say, isn't that a kind of metaphysical anthropocentrism? Or a kind of hubris you have? Why do you think you're special? Or why do you think we're special as human beings? It's kind of funny. If anyone to really articulate this, and I think people do at least implicitly, they're a bit like an obnoxious older sibling that says condescendingly, "Do you really think the world was made just for you?" And to this, the Thomist, or really any Christian or anyone that accepts the Old Testament, says, "Yes, and for you too. The world was made for me and for you." The solution to any concerns, therefore, about the conceptual difficulty or human uniqueness or privilege is not to shy away from it, but to embrace it. St. Thomas Aquinas, drawing upon an earlier tradition, refers to the human soul as a kind of horizon of creation. I really like this image. I think it's a useful analogy to make. I think it summarizes a lot of his teaching. He quotes Dionysius the Areopagite in saying, in this interesting axiom, that divine wisdom joins the ends of what is superior with the beginnings of what is inferior. And so what's highest is joined to what's lowest, in other words. So the human body touches upon the lower part of the higher genus of spiritual substances through the human soul. So anyway, this is kind of a mouthful to just extract this quote on its own. But the bottom line is that the intellectual soul, our human soul, is a certain horizon or border, as it were, between the corporeal and the incorporeal, insofar as it's an incorporeal substance that nevertheless has a corporeal form. It's kind of, I really hope this quote will make more sense at the end of the talk, but I understand it's a little bit opaque here at the beginning. But just as heaven and earth meet at the horizon, so too there's a profound and spectacular union of what is beloved, what is above, and what is below. If you think about it, we as human beings are the only creatures that belong to two domains, to both domains of creation, the spiritual and the material. So we're a point of unique and profound continuity within creation, a horizon. In a similar way, Aquinas refers to human nature as a kind of summary of all creation. It's a very similar idea. He calls man a microcosm, or a little world, minor mundus, summarizing kind of creation altogether in one substance. So before we get into the human being as a composite of body and soul, I think it'd be helpful for us to think about creation in general. Why did God create? We could go through many, many explanations. But the bottom line is to manifest and communicate his goodness. God created in order to communicate his goodness, to impart something of his own likeness. Every agent makes something like itself, and God is no exception. In fact, he's the principle that grounds the rule. So we could think about creation from God's perspective for a moment. That's really what I'm intending to do. If God's going to create, how do you think he chooses what types of things he's going to make? So keep in mind the goal is to manifest his goodness, to communicate his goodness. So God wants to make, you know, as he creates something that imitates himself in some way. You say, okay, well, what's the easiest way to do that? Is God going to just copy himself? No. Well, he can't copy himself, strictly speaking, because you can't have two infinite beings, right? That would be two gods. Or, you know, he could have just made one thing that's of a marvelous and unimaginable dignity, something greater than the highest of the seraphim. But if you think about it, even that would fall infinitely short of him. He also could have made just one type of thing and made a lot of them, a universe full of humpback whales, an entire terrain of lemurs. If you think about it, that's pretty much what Madagascar is. If the whole universe were just like Madagascar. In principle, God could have done any of these, but it was more fitting for him to make a bunch of different things, a multitude of varied kinds of things. My favorite of Aquinas' analogies for this is circumlocution. Those of you who've studied a lot of foreign languages, you know when you go and you try to speak a foreign language, it's very important to know how to circumlocute, you know? When you don't know, oh, what's the word for that? I don't know, but I can tell you in like five sentences. It's the thing that you put in the door and then turn. Oh, the key. Yeah, the key. That's right. I get the word now. So in a similar way, Aquinas says that in his desire to communicate and manifest his infinite perfection, God uses a multitude of varied creatures of varied degrees. Just as when there's no single word that matches our concept, we need to use a whole bunch of words and even sentences. And philosophers do this all the time when they make definitions or when they're arriving at one. But we all do it. We struggle for the right word, and when it doesn't exist, we keep talking. You know, it's like when you go outside and you can smell that it's going to rain or that it is raining. I don't know that there's one word that describes that, so that's why I had to say a whole sentence. Okay, there is one. Oh, there goes my example. Okay. Well, okay. I'm going to have to. That's good. Now I know. Now I can use it in the example. So too, God, in creating through his perfect and eternal word, the divine concept, as it were, uses many finite created words even to begin to express himself. A universe of humpback whales would be boring and full of moaning. Also, they'd at least need some water to swim in and plankton. And lemurs alone would leave us lacking, and they'd need trees to hop on and fruit to eat. This is a silly way of arriving at the point, but the fittingness of creation requires diversity and difference. And so God creates different things. And where there's difference, there's hierarchy. So what are the fundamental different types of things that help make the universe complete? Well, we could carve up the whole hierarchy of being in different ways, and Aquinas does in different ways. But I think one that's just very helpful to use is a category of threes, or is a triad, that of being, life, and intellect. Because he says, at least in one place, when he's commenting on the Liber de Causis, he says, well, really, you can consider everything in terms of its existence, and then there's some things that are more precious than just existing things that are also living, and then some things yet more precious than that, more dignified in their being, and those are the things that are intelligent. Whether animals that are capable of like a certain basic sense knowledge or human beings that are capable of intellectual knowledge. So I have a kind of long quote for that that I'll go ahead and pass over. God, who is being itself, can be participated in diverse ways, and it's fitting that he be so. There are things that merely exist, but also living and intelligent things. They participate, essay, in diverse ways according to their determinate natures. I'm just passing over this quickly as a way to frame the discussion of the human person, just passing through this. So this isn't my main point. So if it feels a little bit foreign, don't despair. So there's rocks and water that just exist, but there's also trees and grass that are alive. There are whales and lemurs that are self-moving and have sensation. But lastly, there are ourselves who have intellectual knowledge. And all of this together, in a way, redounds to the perfection of the universe. So, with this notion of hierarchy in mind, I'd like to turn and actually consider the metaphysical composition of human beings in terms of form and matter. So, you might say, I've been considering creation from a Neoplatonic angle just to set the stage. And now we want to zoom in and analyze things in a more Aristotelian mode. We want to arrive at Aquinas' notion of the human person, but we have to consider matter and form first, since one of the most helpful things we can say about the human person, or about living things generally, is that the soul is the form of the body. The soul is the form of the body. It doesn't do us much good to say that unless we understand matter and form in an Aristotelian sense, or at least once we at least begin with Aristotle. Matter and form are correlative principles that explain the composition of everything in the world. Just like substance and accidents, act and potency, essence and existence, matter and form need to be considered as a correlative pair. So we can speak of the material and formal cause of a thing, and this is precisely what we're getting at. There are material constituents of a thing that are sensible and quantifiable, but there's also the formal cause or form which makes a thing to be what it is. In a way, it gives it existence. It's not the ultimate giver of existence, but it's its formal cause. When something undergoes a substantial change, the matter remains the same, or at least some of the matter remains present, but the form changes. The theory that appeals to this composition of matter and form as a way of explaining things is called hylomorphism. From hule, for matter, I think literally even wood, some of you probably know better than I in the Greek, hule and morphe for form. Okay, that's all rather abstract, and it was actually difficult to just say all of that without beginning to give you an example. And that was on purpose. I haven't given you an example of something being composed of matter and form yet. Because part of the difficulty, this is part of what I'm trying to convey as the central point, part of the difficulty in explaining matter and form, and part of what leads to confusion and a mischaracterization of Aquinas or Aristotle, is that when we turn to offer examples, any given example is going to be rather limited because it's going to belong to a particular part, let's say, of the hierarchy of creatures. So, you know, if you're familiar with analogy, it's to be understood analogically. As an undergraduate, if you learn a little bit of Aristotle, and you're reading the physics, or you're reading the De Anima, and you hear matter and form, and, you know, the example we get at the beginning is the bronze statue, you know? And you think, okay, great, I understand it. Statue is the shape, bronze is the matter, form is the shape, you know, it all works, I understand it all. The whole universe is just like statues. No, we actually need to start there. But there's a much more important point to be made, but it involves a kind of purification of concepts. I mean, we could even start at a more basic level, like Aristotle does, with the syllable ba. It's really boring. So, is that just B and A? No, it's ba. It's B and A together in a particular form. It's not just the material constituents of B and A. So, if this doesn't blow your mind, it's because I don't think it should. But anyway, we could talk about form in a very basic way. So the next step up really is the statue. We talk about the statue, you know, the bronze is the matter, and the form is the shape or impression of the person it represents. So if we have a statue of Socrates, the form, as it were, is the shape of the statue. So in a lot of ways, this is, you know, again, just basic. It's especially because when we think about it changing, even if it was disfigured or completely reshapen, it would still be a kind of bronze statue of sorts. Anyway, I'm gonna leave the statue for now. You can tell I don't like it. You can tell I'm unsatisfied. Because a lot of people's understanding of matter and form remains at that level. And my point is it needs to be purified. So we need to move upwards in the hierarchy of creatures to living things to get a better idea of form. Because living things are really the best examples of matter-form composites. In living things, the soul or principle of life is their form. Form is the principle of unity, holds things together in an organized way, and coordinates the functions of various organs. It's so vivid in living things. One of the books that you'll be having for this retreat, maybe you discovered it already in your bag, is by E. Monnet, a French Dominican who has this wonderful three books that are Introduction to Philosophy, and this is a Philosophy of the Human Person. I really invite you to read that if you have a little time throughout the retreat, because it's written in such a kind of meditative mode that I think it'll really benefit, you know, no matter how much you already know about Aquinas and the human person, it's written in such a meditative and reflective mode that draws in poetry and literary examples that I think you'll find it rather engaging. Anyway, E. Monnet says that he gives you a good sense of how form is to be understood in living things as a kind of driving forward. And in a way, it's the soul that fashions organs for itself, you might say. Now, we got to go up through different living things, too. Plants are so basic, you know, they give us a good image for the soul's unifying and actualizing activity. Even the orchid drives forth from its seminal state to a flourishing and healthy example of its kind. Or in animals, the soul is also responsible for the more sophisticated functions of the exterior and interior senses and movement. So in living things, we see the absolute necessity of form. A living thing can't be a living thing without its soul, without its form. And no one likes to talk about dead animals, but this is the point at which you almost have to, right? When you're giving a talk about what is it to, you know, to talk about soul in a living thing. Well, the roadkill is no longer a deer. The roadkill is no longer a raccoon, but just the remains of one. The relics of a body once fashioned by a co-principle, the soul, that no longer exists. The souls of plants and of non-human animals are sometimes also called material souls. And this could be a little bit misleading term. It's not that the souls themselves are material, it's just that they're bound up with matter and can't exist without it. So, of course, Thomistic Institute made a splash on social media with the coffee mugs that say your dog is not going to heaven. And I really think mug 2.0 needs to say, don't worry, your dog has a soul, but he's still not going to heaven. Could be on the other side. So it's important to talk about the souls of plants and of non-rational animals, even before talking about human beings, just because it already begins to help us purify our concepts. So, for example, when we ask the question, where is the soul? For example, where is the soul in the orchid? Or where is the soul in the lemur? Is it in its tail? Is it in its ears? No. Well, when you understand matter and form correctly, it's even more strange than asking, where is the shape in the statue? It's a statue of Socrates. Oh, where's the Socrates shape? No, as though it were some part buried within. Well, the right answer is, well, it's sort of everywhere. It's part and parcel with the thing itself. And so too with living things, the soul is in, as it were, all parts of the body. It's the unifying and life-giving power, or its unifying and life-giving power is felt everywhere, is actualized everywhere. So in a way, it's better to say that the soul contains the body than that the body contains the soul. And now, right, so you've immediately formed an image in your mind. As soon as I say, well, it's really the soul that contains the body. You've probably already imagined, or at least you're about to, a kind of circular cloud hovering around the body, right? And that image has obvious drawbacks. What's meant is simply that the soul gives unifying and actualizing form to the body. But I guess, you know, if you have to choose between the Cartesian view of the soul somewhere in the pineal gland and the cloud hovering around the body, I think choose the cloud. I think it represents progress. You know, progress in philosophy is often a matter of moving from a really bad analogy for something to a slightly less bad analogy for something. So what about people? Just as there is a jump from animals to plants, there's an even bigger jump from non-rational to rational animals, in a way. There's a much bigger jump. The way we understand matter and form composition needs to be a little bit different, too, more refined and elevated because of our greater ontological dignity. The hylomorphism of the human composite is not like anything else, really. The human soul stands to the body as form to matter. To be human is to be composed of a body and soul. And here's the key difference. The human soul, while taken on its own, is an incomplete substance, but it does subsist. It's subsistent, meaning it can exist without the body. But the converse is not true. The body cannot exist without the soul. You might say, well, yeah, I know that. That's straightforward. But it's actually kind of striking when you think about it, when you think about the consequences of that. Because think of the way the way we think of accompanying someone who's dying, right? Death is the separation of body and soul. And really, as soon as someone dies, whenever exactly that is, and that's a whole other question of the definition of death, as soon as someone dies, what we see before us is no longer, properly speaking, even their body. It's the remains or a corpse. It's not their body in the strict sense, in the sense it was during their lifetime. Why? Because it's ceased to be informed by the soul. So at the same time, we know that the soul depends on the body for a lot of things too. To be able to sense the external world, to listen, to learn, to interact, to move. However, this dependence is not quite as extreme. The body is absolutely dependent on the soul, but the soul is only relatively dependent on the body. Another way of saying is, while the body is intrinsically dependent on the soul is only extrinsically dependent on the body. You know that there's like a great Thomist moment when we've broken out intrinsic and extrinsic. You know, you feel like there's many who feel like they can just drop the mic at that point. It's like, see, I've explained it. You know, I've appealed to some exciting new vocab words. You know? So you might now say, time out. Or at least many would. Isn't this all a way of really saying that the soul and the body are separate things? Isn't the whole hylomorphic idea destroyed? Because if the soul can exist without the body, how unified can it really be when it's united with the body? We might think it relegates the soul to the status of something like the space shuttle that sheds its rockets before making it into space. We think, well, no surprise there. We could tell just looking at the launch pad that the top part was the only part that really mattered and the only part that was going to last. So this is the best I could think of for an image. You know, we might be tempted, oh, okay, well, the soul is like existing in its own compartment. No, it can just kind of detach. But it's not like this. The soul's not carved out in its own particularity in such a way that it never truly shares itself with the body. Rather, the soul informs the body. Actually, Aquinas says, it imparts, this is, if I can give you one insight, I think it's this one. The soul imparts a greater unity to the body than any lower form does to its matter. He says, something is, quote, something is no less unified from being composed of an intellectual substance and a material body, but is in fact more so. Since by however much the form excels the matter is made greater in oneness. So, what does this mean? In ourselves, in anyone, the human soul, joined with a human body, possesses a greater unity than any statue, plant, or even any non-human animal we see. So, how do we know all of this? This is its own talk, right? How do we have knowledge of the soul? Well, the human epistemological capacities that we have reveal that we have an operation that doesn't belong completely to a physical organ. We can abstract. We can think abstractly and freely choose. We can, of course, talk more about this, but it's a very important point. But when you bring this up, people will always challenge it, and they will also always come back to animal intelligence, to animal intelligence that seems to be basically a sign of abstraction. You might say, well, I know some pretty smart dolphins. You know, I know some pretty smart chimpanzees. But no matter what we find in the world of brute animals in terms of intelligence, it's of a qualitatively inferior order. Smart parrots talk, but they don't write dictionaries. Dolphins might count, but they can't do calculus. We need to also note what is perhaps the single most unique and significant part of Aquinas' account of the human person. This is now where I'm kind of skipping stones through some of the main points, but they'll recur in, of course, the other talks. So, and we have plenty of discussion time. And plus, we're all staying here, so we have plenty of time to talk about it. What's the most, perhaps, unique and significant part of Aquinas' account? Well, it's that the unicity of substantial form, the oneness, the fact that in the human person there is only one form, only one substantial form. Because many felt the need before Aquinas and during his time, and even after, to say that there were multiple forms in the human person. For example, a soul or a separate form, as it were, that does the vegetative functions of nutrition and growth and digestion. Or another for the sensitive functions that runs the external senses and interior senses. But Aquinas will remind us that as soon as you start multiplying forms, you lose unity. In a way, you create a new threat to unity every time you add an additional principle of unity. Now, the latest and greatest controversy of our time is not the multiplicity of substantial forms in the human person, but it's important to be aware of and to know exactly one of the issues this is arising out to be able to appreciate the uniqueness of Aquinas' account. So Aquinas won't brook this type of partitioning. The same soul responsible for digestion is the soul responsible for thinking. The soul that actualizes the body to sense and move is the soul that is responsible for freedom, or the soul is responsible for free choice. When you think about it, it's marvelous to think in us, again, as a kind of summary of creation, as a profound principle of continuity and unity, we combine in ourselves the banal and the sublime, the animalial and the divine, all in the same soul. Of course, we want to distinguish different faculties, and we can get deeper into that and all of that, but it's worth noting. It's also important to say that these claims about the soul are being made on philosophical grounds, because you know a lot of people, when they hear the word soul, immediately think, oh, we're talking about religious belief, and they shut down, or they think, oh, that's something you know because of a religious experience you've had. And for now, many of us maybe that's certainly what came first, but we came to know philosophy second. But it's important to talk about what we're arguing on and the domain within which we're arguing. The soul is not of itself supernatural, and therefore we don't need revelation, strictly speaking, to know of its existence or something of its immaterial and spiritual nature. Revelation certainly confirms what we know through philosophy about the soul, or what we can reason to. God breathed into Adam and Eve the breath of life, the spiritual soul. And further, we can say something about the immortality of the soul on philosophical grounds. Insofar as the soul itself is not composed of smaller parts, it doesn't corrupt. So it's incorruptible and immortal. But to say much more about life after death, we really need to appeal to revelation, because the resurrection is not a philosophical conclusion. And to learn of the beatific vision, we need more than a syllogism. That was a half rhyme. I was really proud of that one. Understanding something of Aquinas' account, therefore, kind of moving towards the end here. I have plenty of time for questions. Understanding something of Aquinas' account helps to pacify concerns about the compatibility of the findings of neuroscience and a proper understanding of the human person as body and soul. Some think neuroscience has filled in gaps that had been left to an understanding of the soul. But in a way, the soul never fit into gaps in the first place. It's not a spirit that fills into explanatory gaps. It's present everywhere. And though it's immaterial and invisible, we have an incredibly good manifestation of it. The manifestation of its work and its activity, its powers and effect. What am I talking about? The human body. Living, breathing, acting. There's a phrase I've seen attributed to many different people, or at least more than one, that when asked, what's the best way to represent the soul? What's the best image we have for it? And the response is, well, the human body. Also, just to answer the question about modern concerns, Thomas Aquinas would be totally comfortable, in a way does, admit that the internal sense powers, things like imagination and the images produced by our imagination, are seated in corporeal organs. Read lots of brain stuff. So that's why we should expect to see certain patterns emerge in the brain that correspond to certain thoughts and choices. But correlation, of course, is different than causality. We'd make a big mistake if we took a reductivist turn and said that because we can measure and quantify and predict certain neural activity, we know everything about human thought and action, and it's reducible to everything that we can quantify and observe. Understanding the human person as a composite of body and soul, we can also pacify some of the concerns I raised at the beginning. It's true, we're not like anything else. And saying that we are what we are exactly as rational animals demands a great deal of conceptual rigor. We must purify our concepts. And hopefully you can see, if we make exceptions for ourselves as human beings, it's not unwarranted. If the human person shines out as a somewhat puzzling anomaly in comparison, a puzzling anomaly in comparison to the rest of creation, it's not without due cause. Rather, our nature is divinely willed, and so it's okay to stand out a little bit from the world that's been made for us. We're a summary or a microcosm of that very world. And it's fitting for the perfection of creation that there not only be varied kinds of things, but something that summarizes everything, a fundamental joint or hinge at the heart of the created universe, at the heart of the universe of creatures. Our bodies, through their union with our souls, are the most glorious and precious thing we can see. And our souls stand out, as Aquinas says, quote, as a horizon of creation, as the highest and noblest of forms. Thank you.
How do you talk about potentiation for life? So, a single cell organism that develops into a person.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you're talking about with the process of evolution or with the ordinary development of a person?
Ordinary development.
Okay, from an embryo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's where you see. I think you'll like the Imone book and what's in there in regard to this, but it's important. Obviously, this has a lot of moral overtones when we get into ethics and abortion and all of that, but to set that aside for a moment to think, okay, at what point is the specifically human put in here, you know? And there's a marvelous kind of wonder in contemplating it's all there from the beginning in potency, you know? And I mean, all of the subsequent things are there in potency, but the human soul is part of that conception, you know. And obviously, we need to reckon with the fact that there's a different embryology at work in Aquinas. It comes up in different ways, partly relevant to the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, actually, and regarding when Mary could have first been recipient of grace and things like that. So this is all in the background. It is like a complicated thing. But I guess your question specifically is, how do we help people to see that a person's a person no matter how small, as it were, to quote Dr. Seuss. I mean, I think partly it's to give them a more sort of truly and robustly biological account. And say, like, look, this isn't like some special religious external thing I'm appealing to, so much as look at the development of a human person. You know, it's on an ordinary trajectory. We can see where this is going. I don't know that I have a whole lot of great apologetic kind of responses, though, right, on fresh in my mind. Maybe others do. Maybe another question will kind of get towards this one, too.
So, so you said that we can understand form without matter, but not matter without form, right? And form is the unifying principle.
Mm-hmm.
Then you also gave the example of how a dead animal would just continue to decompose because it's lost its unifying principle.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's in my mind, though, it's difficult to imagine how just like things like rocks or boulders have a form or a unifying principle, since they do seem to just deteriorate like a dead animal.
Yeah.
So that might constitute as just something that's just matter.
Mm-hmm.
So then how would you respond?
Right. So this is where so you'll hear the soul spoken of as a substantial form. And this is where we distinguish between substantial and accidental form. This is really the big difference between the statue or the boulder, and because statues, a lot of statues are really just shaped boulders, you know, like Mount Rushmore. Between a substantial form and an accidental form. So, you know, the raccoon has a kind of formal quality to it that makes it identifiable still, the raccoon corpse. Isn't it funny when you have to, I can't think of a more pleasant example. Sorry. You know, this is, there's an interesting thing. Part of this gets into philosophy of nature and our understanding of prime matter. What do we mean by prime matter? And, well, because, like, you're like, okay, St. Thomas, show me where the prime matter is. What's the most basic of things? Is it at the elements? Is it subatomic particles? Is it something we haven't discovered yet? And, I mean, this isn't my specialty, but there's some things going on here that are very interesting. Because he maintains that matter never exists on its own. That's, in a way, if we didn't maintain that, we'd kind of be missing the point. Because form is so important when it comes to the existence of something, right? So, you know, we think, okay, St. Thomas, what's your account of creation? Did God, like, just create a bunch of prime matter, but then since then, well, it's all taken on various forms. It's like, no, in a way, prime matter can't exist on its own without some kind of form. And you're right, some are very basic and unimpressive and are a little bit more like the syllable ba, like, what is it that keeps together, or that truly speaking gives a kind of formal existence or formal cause to boulders or minerals or anything like that. This is where, you know, I love that there are a lot of people interested in kind of reconciling modern science with philosophy of nature. And a lot of work actually needs to be done on that. And, you know, for Aquinas' account, for Aristotle, we're talking, well, there's the four elements, and those are the kind of basic constituents. But even in that case, there's a formal quality to that. So it's not easy when you go down. So that's part of the difficulty of explaining hylomorphism. You kind of got to start somewhere in the middle and then sort of show people up higher in the chain of being and then try to explain a little bit better as you go down, and you do your best. Yeah.
So I think it's really powerful to appeal to people to say, like, we have these, you know, capacities, and often talking about them in cognitive terms, mm-hmm. and saying, like, this is very good basis to think that humans are different qualitatively in their mm-hmm. abilities. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's powerful, but what it's often countered with is that human cognitive capacities have these errors that mm-hmm. they make, for example, like abstraction, or, I mean, lots of things, like our approximation abilities, which are, like, so efficient, are also prone to, like, extreme error. Mm-hmm. So people would often say, like, well, yeah, it's like a benefit, but it comes at a cost. And if you use, like, animalistic, like, reasoning, which mm-hmm. is very similar to, like, machine reasoning, mm-hmm. you would get better results in certain cases, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so I feel like that's, like, a competing, mm-hmm. I don't know, tension
right.
with talking to people about this, and why it's qualitatively, why like humans aren't qualitatively better, which is the case that it has to be made, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know how.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That, like, we have profound abilities, but we also mess up gloriously, you know. And in a way, I mean, if you think about this, obviously, adding a further layer with theology, no one can mess up more, you know. We've been given so much, and no one can mess up more, because, you know, if the raccoon walks in the middle of the road and dies, well, okay, he was going to die anyway. But, you know, we make serious life decisions that have eternal consequences, and, you know, the one who's been given so much can also mess up in a profound way as well. So I'm going kind of to a further level with theology to appeal to that, but you're making a very good point. I would just say, and this is one of my favorite images, and this isn't like an awesome objection to that or something that's necessarily going to persuade people, but it is a fitting way to consider the qualitative leaps we see in creation and how to maintain that there is a similarity between the lower and the higher, but there's still a kind of leap. So there's a staircase in Rome, and this is, I guess, a common kind of staircase called a cordonata, where, you know, you have distinct grades, but then you have, like, a leap, you know? So, like, horses can go up, you know? You're like, thinking, where is this going? I think that the hierarchy of creation is better conceived of.
Is this tilted, or is it just?
No, this is like we're going up the stairs.
It's supposed to be tilted,
right? Yeah, it has to be tilted.
Like this? Oh, this part's tilted, you mean?
Yeah,
that's what I'm intending to convey, sorry.
Okay.
this is great, right? So basically, each grade of being we have falling in a particular way. And even within those, so, you know, where I said wherever there's difference, there's distinction and there's hierarchy. And so whenever you have two different species, even, you know, we're talking about angels, two different angels, okay. Maybe not everyone here wants to hear about angels. But different species of animals, let's say, there's going to be one that's higher than the other. And we also notice that there's a leap, but there's also a kind of similarity here at this point. So plants, they can grow, they can't move themselves. Then you think of imperfect animals like oysters, who actually have a kind of sensation and a more sophisticated makeup than plants, but they're imperfect, and there's a kind of intermediate grade there. So the point with all of this is to say that we can expect, in fact, it's no surprise, given God has set up the universe the way he has, and given it's fitting that he has done so, we can expect to find rather intelligent non-human animals. No? But we want to maintain that I need to, again, you know, I said you draw one image and then you draw it better. That the leaps are actually bigger. I have trouble drawing, I guess. That the leaps are actually much bigger than any of the variation that takes place within. So within the whole domain of non-human animals, the variation is going to be rather small in comparison to this qualitative jump. Even though we expect to see something very interesting here and something very interesting here that have a kind of very strange similarity, or I should say very, what's the word, an imperfect similitude of the other. This is part of a whole other kind of account of the hierarchy being in participation, but I think it's useful, and it's like, you know, with this metaphysics and with this notion of participation, you're not surprised to discover very smart things. And now, the question of human error is another very fascinating one, but sorry, I don't have anything fresh on my mind to answer to. How's everyone circling?
I mean, so we say corrupts your optimum pessimum.
That's what I was thinking.
The best of the corruption of the best is the worst, right? So with all the faculties we have, we can also blunder the most. But I think you also allude to something that Nietzsche also says. He says, I mean, we're sort of the most bungled kind of animal because the animals are sort of embedded in the ecological niche. They have all the instincts they need to survive in it, and that's a smooth flow, basically, in which they operate. And we just don't fit in anywhere. But I think we're also not bound to any ecological niche. That's quite a leap, right? I mean, we can design our own ecological niche. We can build habitations that were not there before. We can live on the North Pole or something like that. No animal can do that. You know? So much as we might mess things up, we also have much larger options there. Yeah.
So thank you for your attention.